Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers and sisters. Welcome to today's chapter of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International. A special welcome to all our listeners online and our listeners on Radio Al Ansar as well. I'm your host for today, Mustafa Darsot, standing in for brother A.B. Dawji. Well, people, I'm sure that a lot of you are talking about World Cup and what has happened, especially since the opening ceremony this past Sunday. I spoke a lot about the controversy prior to the World Cup starting a week ago. And of course, a lot has happened in between. But nevertheless, we'll touch on that a bit later. Just let's focus a bit on some local stuff. Yesterday was Black Friday, that once a year crazy day sale, which has obviously overtaken Christmas rush to such a point that people go broke after Black Friday. And that's followed by what is day after tomorrow called Cyber Monday. And they found, guess what, to be the biggest sales drivers for yesterday's Black Friday. It was diapers, cooking oil, and surprisingly, air fryers. That's a big contrast, because air fryers, you don't need cooking oil. But those are the items that were in big demand, apart from, of course, TVs and cell phone contracts. In fact, all dealers, whether it was MTN, Vodacom, Telkom, they were busy right through. In fact, those specials will carry on for the next week. So if you want to grab that one deal where you can have enough data, and that's what we all need is data, but also we mustn't forget we need reliable data, because when you have load shedding, your data goes out the window, no matter how much you can stand upside down. So that's what's been happening as far as the frenzy is concerned. On a more serious note, just this week, police were on high alert after Monday's court ruling that, in fact, two very important court rulings took place, one on the former president Jacob Zuma and the other one on the assassin of Chris Hani, Janusz Walus. So the NAT joints, known as the National Joint Operational and Intelligence Structure, had taken note of both judgments and remained on high alert to respond to any eventuality. However, here, being on the ground in Durban, especially being the hot zone after what happened in July last year, people were not confident. In fact, people were panicking but remained on high alert, because you couldn't see any visible policing, whether it was from the SAPS or the Durban Metro Police or the Army. However, what happened was that at least we must make shukr to Allah Ta'ala that sanity prevailed and there was no violence or a repeat of July 2021. So what were these two court rulings all about? The Supreme Court of Appeal ruled that the former Correctional Services boss, Arthur Fraser, that notorious character who was before the boss of intelligence, who has made up this bizarre claim of the Pala Pala scandal of the $4 million cash and how he arrived at the figure, only God knows, unlawfully authorized Zuma's release on medical parole in September last year. Now, you would remember that Zuma had just served under 2 months of his 15-month sentence at the Escort prison. He was arrested, of course, in July last year for the contempt of the Constitutional Court. And what happened? There was the big hoo-ha, and that led to the July 2021 riots. This time round, although he has to go back to prison, the Department of Correctional Services has said that they will appeal the ruling. Whether they take it back to the Supreme Court of Appeal or whether they take it to the apex court known as the Constitutional Court is left to be seen. However, there was the other matter, was a unanimous Constitutional Court ruling was read out by Chief Justice Raymond Zondo about granting parole to Janusz Walus, right, who was the Polish immigrant that was jailed, has been jailed for almost 30 years now, and he was actually eligible for parole after serving 17 years. He was eligible for parole nearly 17 years ago. Almost 17 years ago, he was already eligible for parole after serving 13 years and 4 months of his life sentence. So, however, he's been denied each time, but this time around, he's been granted parole. And for good reasons, too. And of course, there's been a lot of hoo-ha. There's been the biggest heavy-handed criticisms. In fact, one again of encouraging violence has been coming out from none other than Jacob Zuma's daughter, Duduzile Zuma, the one of the twins. And of course, she was notorious to be on social media last year, especially on Twitter, for encouraging the violence that took place. And now is also making a noise. But again, as we say, we must thank God that there's been sanity has prevailed, and what she wanted to achieve did not materialize. But does not mean that we must be complacent and sit back as if nothing will happen. So that's been the two matters. There's been a lot of criticism over this matter. In fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the ANC today is protesting outside the Constitutional Court over this decision to grant Yanush Walush parole. And it's the first time also, ironically, in 28 years since the ANC has been in power, or 28 and a half years, that they're actually protesting outside the Constitutional Court, the very constitutional which they have been very instrumental by their top leaders in drawing up. So, which comes to this is that at the end of the day, what you've created comes back to bite you at the end of the day as a responsible government, and that's what they should be. I mean, corruption aside, but as a responsible government, they have to abide by what the court's rulings are, especially the Constitutional Court, which is the highest court in the land. So that's what's been happening there. Now you've heard about the top six. Yes, top six elections are taking place very soon at the elective conference within the month of December. And they've already announced the top six nominations. Yes. So for the president of the ANC, the two people running are the incumbent president, Cyril Ramaphosa, and former health minister, who is no stranger to controversy and scandals, Dr. Zweli Mkhize. For national chairperson, you've got the incumbent there, Gwede Mantashe, along with David Masondo and Stanley Matabate. Right? Secretary General post, you've got Mdumiseni Ntuli, Pumulo Maswele and Fikile Mbalula. For deputy president position, you've got Paul Mashatile, Ronald Lamula, and Oscar Mobuyane. For treasurer, it's Benjani Chauke, Pule Mabe, Mzwandile Masina. You know that notorious former ex-mayor of Ikurileni? Yes, he wants to be the treasurer. And deputy secretary general, of course, a controversial figure there is Nomvula Mokonyane. And there's Phoebe Podhita Kumule. Now, these are the nominations, okay? And if you look at most of them, you've got three people there, but apparently there's a threshold that needs to be met in order to feature as those nominations. And Lindiwe Sisulu, yes, the tourism minister, the daughter of former ANC stalwarts Walter Sisulu and Albertina Sisulu, who must be turning in graves right now because given the controversial behavior of their daughter Lindiwe, has objected to this. In fact, she's made a big noise and said that wants to know and demanding to say that she met the 25% threshold and wants to know why does she not feature as one of the three candidates for the ANC president position. So, in other words, to be alongside Cyril Ramaphosa, Zweli Mkhize, and of course herself. So, the ANC's electoral committee chairperson is the former president, Halema Motlanthe. And she said that the Lindiwe Sisulu's assertion that she qualifies to be in the top three nominations running for the party president is puzzling and preposterous. So in response to her earlier letter, Motlanthe clarified that her name had not been proposed because she had not even received the highest number of nominations in any of the nine provinces or the three ANC leagues. So the ANC's women, youth and veteran leagues are treated as provinces at the conference. So what Motlanthe said added that the 25% threshold alluded to provinces for nominations from the delegates at the province. Now at the conference, sorry. Now listen to this. According to the official and verified records in possession of the electoral committee, right? This is now President, former President Kgalema Motlanthe addressing Walters Lindiwe Sisulu to say that according to the, he's addressing her directly, according to the official and verified records in possession of the electoral committee, you received a total of, now this is where it sounds funny, 66 nominations. Yes, that's correct, 66 nominations. You would have noted that the other two unsuccessful nominees who received more branch general meeting nominations than you did, right, do not feature. In light of this, your contention that you qualify to be amongst the top three nominees for the position of president is somewhat puzzling and preposterous. So, poor lady only got 66 nominations out of all nine provinces and all the three ANC different leagues of the Women, Youth and Veteran Leagues. And she wants to think that she is presidential material. Come on, Lindiwe Sisulu, give it up and can it, please. All right, moving to news abroad. As I said, we'll talk about the World Cup later. There's talking about elections, talking about politics. Malaysia had elections earlier this week, and you saw that a very interesting outcome had taken place. So interesting that it resulted in a hung parliament result. In other words, there was no clear contender, no clear winner. And this time around, there were three groupings vying for the top post. In the last election in 2018, where you had the Barisan Nasional, which was known as the National Front, against the Pakatan Harapan, led by Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, as two groupings vying for the top post, and the Pakatan Harapan caused the biggest upset, right? Leading to what I explained to you last week, for the first time that the ruling party since independence of almost 61 years lost their power. And this time around, there were three groupings and there couldn't be a clear-cut majority. So in stepped in the Yang Di Pertuan Agong, right? That's the Malay term for the king or the sultan, right? In short form, they call him the Agong, A-G-O-N-G, which means king. Right, so the country's Agong or King Sultan Abdullah Sultan Ahmad Shah named Anwar Ibrahim the Prime Minister this past Thursday at 5 p.m., which was 11 a.m. South African time, ending 5 days of political paralysis following national elections in which Malay supremacists and Islamists led by former Prime Minister Mohidin fared unexpectedly better than anticipated, taking 72 seats in the 222-member parliament, although the Rural Islamist Party, Islamist Malaysia, known as PAS-PAS, emerged as the biggest single party with 49 seats. Anwar's reputation as a moderate should quell fears of rising religious fervor. And the man waited 30 years, right? 30 years since he's been in the government. From the early 90s, he served as the country's deputy prime minister under Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, at the same time doubled up as finance minister until he fell from grace in 1998. So basically, Anwar Ibrahim, the 75-year-old, popularly known as the reformist leader, has finally won this prize after him being jailed twice over the years. Right. So the Agong, His Royal Highness, reminds all parties that the winners do not win all and the losers do not lose everything. This is according to a palace statement. So the king called on Anwar Ibrahim and his coalition to be humble and said all opposing parties should ensure a stable government. There is speculation that the sultan tilted towards Anwar Ibrahim out of a rising concern over the emergence of PAS, the Islamic party, as a suddenly potent political force. So the whole idea was that the PAS, which is the Party Islam in Malaysia, right, which is the Islamist party, and winning 49 out of the 200 seats out of the 222 member parliament, is seen to be a force and they needed to be contended with. The fear is that PAS is very radical. Of course, nowhere to be like the Taliban, but in Malay society terms, a moderate society, a tolerant society across all religions and cultures, being the major religion of Islam, followed by Buddhism, Christianity, and Hinduism, as well as traditional religions, and of course the races in Malaysia of the Malay, Chinese, Indian, as well as other traditionalists. So they have to strike a balance in that country. So Anwar is, of course, led the Pakatan Harapan coalition, right? And he got 82 seats in this election. So there you had it. 72 seats went to the former Prime Minister Mohideen, right? And then, of course, 82 seats to Anwar's coalition. And But however, as I mentioned to you last week, that any one party needed 112 seats to lead the 222-member parliament or 222-member seat parliament, requiring him to return to what they known as his former party, the Barisan Nasional, right? Of course, the main party being UMNO, the United Malays Organization, right? To reach a majority with a unity government. The resultant coalition is more attractive to the kampong classes, meaning the people of the village. Kampong is a Malay word for village. The ruling ethnic Malays, who have long been loyal to the now discarded UMNO because of the taint of corruption, and who have long distrusted Anwar Ibrahim out of belief that Pakatan Harapan was too differential to the ethnic Chinese-dominated Democratic Action Party, which makes up a major part of the coalition. Now, this is where it comes in. There's a lot of ethnic divisions in Malaysia. And of course, under the political umbrella of coalitions, like what they had, the Barisan Nasional, a national front, you get the coming together of the different ethnic groups. But like I mentioned last week, when you had the National Front in power for 61 years from independence, it consisted of UMNO, meaning the United Malays National Organization, which represented the Malay majority, all Muslim, right? Followed by the MCA, which was the Malaysian Chinese Association, and the MIC, which is the Malaysian Indian Congress, and of course a few small traditional parties, and they came together and got this coalition, and that's how they successfully ran the country. Of course, then came in Najib's government and took the country down a downward spiral. In fact, the country is bleeding, and that's why the politics was so important in Malaysia, that saw so many new voters coming on the voter roll, the youth, right, and they all wanted to bring about change. So, of course, the results, although it was a hung parliament, although there was no clear-cut majority, the thing is that Malaysian people want reformation. So, as I said, the racial situation seems to have played some sort of role, or the usual role it has in this election, right? However, as I said, Mohideen's national coalition, out of fear of losing privileges that have hampered the country's economy since the implementation of the new economic policy, which is an affirmative action for the ethnic Malay majority. And just to give you some stats, that the ethnic Malays, or the Bumiputras, known as the son of the soil, constitute 2/3 of Malaysia's 33 million people. Chinese make up 20 to 25%, and Indians 10%. Right, so this is what's been happening, and now it's all to work from taking office. And by the announcement of Anwar becoming Prime Minister, the stock markets have rallied, okay, and have seen gains for the first time in 2 years, has seen this Malay currency stabilize a bit. So, but however, they've got a lot of challenges. One is to curtail the rising cost of living. In fact, if anything, Malaysia has had one of the cheapest cost of living in the world. The only thing that was expensive in Malaysia, right, was cars, especially your imported cars or your German cars. That cars was the only thing that was expensive, and of course, property in your upmarket areas. Food was absolutely cheap. Your consumer goods were dirt cheap, second to none. In fact, in some cases, were even cheaper than the United States. That's how cheap it was. Not anymore. Of course, not as expensive as South Africa, but they stay, their currency is stable. So if you convert it, it's expensive to us, but for the Malay people, it's definitely very expensive for them. And that's why they wanted to see this change, and now he's got a lot of work ahead of him. And of course, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister who allied with Anwar 4 years ago and his party to bring about the biggest upset in Malaysia's political history, tweeted to congratulate him and wished him well going forward. As well as there were other tweets from other Muslim leaders from around the world, including for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So that's what's happened in Malaysia. Now, it's a bit of a concern over something that has come about, which I just came across this morning. In fact, you know, in the UK politics, it's always been seen that the Tories, which is known as the Conservative Party, are the, should we say, the rubbishes of the political arena in the UK. Like how you have in America, the Republicans compared to the Democrats, right? Because they are more, because of the right-wing tendencies, etc. Although, of course, you've seen with the Tories, they brought in people of color like Rishi Sunak, etc. But people of color, to what extent? At the end of the day, they have to toe policy lines. And then you've got these other parties that are opposed to them, like the Labour Party in the UK, which is seen to be liberal, there for all Britons of all colours. And then in America, you have the Democratic Party, which is there for all Americans of all colours. Right? When you see a Republican Party government in place, you see right-wing policies, be it the time of the two Bushes, father and son. Then when Donald Trump was in power a few years ago, right, in especially bad treatment towards Latinos, Muslims, etc. And then came in Joe Biden, although he's moving towards the senile side in life, but then you've seen a lot of those policies reversed, and you're finding that a lot of Muslims are now featuring in the upper echelons of government, a lot of them working in the White House, working at Capitol Hill, working for the FBI. I don't mean it in the point of one Muslim now get carried away and start making silly comments to say, oh, they're selling our deen. At the end of the day, we have Muslims here in South Africa in the police force, right, in senior positions. Does it mean that they're selling our deen? I mean, look at the recent announcement of the head of intelligence by President Cyril Ramaphosa, a Muslim. Does that mean now they're selling our deen? No. So at the end of the day, you've got this sort of scenario. However, the Labour Party, surprisingly enough, is looking for an election. You know, whenever there's an election, a party tends to use something as a draw card. And they'll obviously go for something controversial. We can see it in South Africa when the EFF makes a noise, stands upside down on there and makes a noise, and of course brings in the part of land, the white man, this, what is ours, that sort of thing, right? The Labour Party, with elections soon approaching next year sometime, have decided to come up with to bring about something controversial, and they want to introduce, right, something which they feel that is the answer to the rising channel crisis. Now, what is the channel crisis? You know, the English Channel, which is between the North France and Southern England, or Southern UK, Britain. Well, they find all the refugees coming in from other parts, especially Eastern Europe, other parts of Europe, Asia, Africa. And they feel that they need something to solve this rising channel crisis. So they shadow immigration minister by the name of Stephen Kinnock believes that the solution lies in introducing, and this is what's very controversial, mandatory national ID cards. Yes, he wants to introduce the carrying of mandatory national ID cards, arguing it would prove we have control of our borders and provide figures on exactly who is living in Britain. And this is not the first time that the Labour Party have sought to introduce such a controversial measure of mandatory ID cards. Back in 2006, when Tony Blair was seeking re-election, he tried to run a similar campaign but was unsuccessful, right? And he used all sorts of excuses. We needed to counter extremism, reduce illegal channel crossing, right? And however, this sort of scheme, one should actually call it a scam, was largely perceived to be a threat to civil liberties and result in a public protest calling for a stop to what was then deemed the database state. Now, of course, what's it almost 20 years later, 18 years later, public attention towards the privacy and ownership of personal data has grown. Government use of citizen records have been seen by many as a breach of personal freedoms. You find in that London is about the most spied, London today is the most spied upon city in the world, with CCTVs in every nook and cranny. They can track your movements walking throughout the city, right? And you got this sort of thing. And unfortunately, people of color will be the biggest targets of these of this mandatory carrying of ID cards. I mean, we have ID cards now here in South Africa. We don't have the old green ID book. We have ID cards. But there's no law that you must carry your ID card on you 24/7 or when you're out of your house. Yes, when you as a driver's license, it's mandatory for you to carry your driver's license, especially when you jump into the vehicle and driving. But that's about it, to identify yourself as a licensed driver. But to carry mandatory ID cards, really, for the so-called free world, this is what's the sort of thing that's happening. And coupled with this, right, there's another controversy that's coming about, that Muslims are to face more discrimination under the new British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Yes, that's the other concern. And this is according to a British political scientist who said that the new Prime Minister was guilty of using discriminatory rhetoric against the Muslim community. Right. According to Suella Braverman, right, who is Rishi Sunak's choice for Home Secretary, came under fire late last month after branding people seeking asylum in the UK, many with darker skin, often from Muslim countries, an invasion. But she has remained at her post despite these xenophobic remarks. Right? Braverman's comments, as well as Rishi Sunak's remarks about Islam and extremism, show the direction of the government's immigration policies. This is according to Turkish Mohammed Chagri Biller of the University of Leeds School of Politics and International Studies. So when Rishi Sunak launched a campaign for the Conservative leadership to become Prime Minister, he produced a discourse such as the fight against Islamic extremism and, of course, equated Islam with terrorism. This is according to Mohammed Biller. He was criticized for ignoring the demands of Muslim deputies to take a clear and stand against Islamophobia. As a result, he received a lot of backlash. A 2019 study found Islamophobia rife within the ruling Conservative Party, and Boris Johnson, who stepped down from the prime ministership in July this year, was known for making Islamophobic remarks. So not much will change during Sunak's term, according to Mohammed Biller, warning that, in fact, we are entering a period where more discrimination awaits Muslims. In the Sunak government's approach on immigration, asylum seekers are categorized and a distinction is made as to whether they really escaped from human rights violations or whether they came with only economic motives. The legitimacy of the asylum requests of those who came by boat, especially via France, is being questioned. Mohammed Biller has said that those seeking asylum in the UK will be strictly examined under the Rwanda plan, which was, of course, announced by the former Home Secretary Priti Patel, right, under the Boris Johnson government, to send asylum seekers that are in Britain to Rwanda. On 24th of October, as we know, Rishi Sunak succeeded Liz Truss as the UK's shortest-serving prime minister. Although he is of Indian origin, but he hails from Africa and is, of course, the country's first prime minister of Asian descent. And married to a very wealthy woman who is part of the Infosys empire, whose father has strong ties to, guess who, Narendra Modi, the prime minister of India, that anti-Muslim party known as the BJP under the auspices of the RSS. So you can see how this all ties in. So when the Labour Party decides now to basically put the nail in the coffin on the head of Muslims by introducing mandatory ID cards, you can see how intertwined all this is. And of course, we've seen the sort of hypocrisy come out by looking at what happened now recently with the World Cup. We spoke about the cost factor of the $220 billion and how only 3% went towards stadiums, etc., and a whole lot of issues, whether it was the banning of alcohol sales at stadiums. Right? But although this has been a unique and controversial situation in many aspects, but the current World Cup in Qatar, right, is of course being hosted by one of the smallest countries in the world, right? And despite not having a huge football tradition, Qatar did win the bid in 2010 and is currently hosting the event, which is the world's biggest sporting event, even bigger than the Olympics, right? Of course, the controversy has been over Qatar's spending of $220 billion for the tournament, right? The Doha government is well aware that hosting the event will not pay off, but is still happy with it as a chance for the small country to boost its image in the world and help foreigners find it on the map. However, Western mainstream media scrutinized and criticized Qatar for its culture, political system, working conditions, etc. While there is, of course, some fair criticism, and I agree, fully agree with this, most of it seems biased and fabricated. We know that Qatar's regional adversaries promoted the publication of anti-Qatar articles in foreign media to discredit Doha's achievements, especially between 2017 and 2021, though it is also true that deliberate anti-Qatari propaganda already existed in Western media as well. Now, the media has particularly hit on Qatar for the working conditions of expat laborers who built the stadiums and the kafala system that requires employers to sponsor the employees. But this is not unique to Qatar. It's in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, all over the Gulf. So in the system, in return for sponsorship, the employer makes contracts with workers which dictate that they cannot leave their job until the contract date expires, which is usually set for between 3 to 5 years. The kafala system has been almost totally abandoned in Qatar, right? Because Qatar wants to embrace the ILO, International Labour Organization framework, but it is still used as a tool to insult the country. Now let's look at the foreign media's coverage. It of course can be argued that foreign media's coverage of Qatar hosting the FIFA World Cup 2022 is hypocritical. For example, when Russia won their bid for hosting the World Cup in 2018 and conducted the event, its labor abuses, human rights abuses, and other deficiencies were not scrutinized much. Of course, the same thing applies to China when it hosted the Olympics in Beijing in 2008. Such criticisms were not much apparent. Were not much apparent or not much of interest, especially when it came to LGBT rights, again, compared to with Russia. When Russia was the host country of the 2018 World Cup, the Russian government's anti-LGBT stance, which in fact got cemented this week, was hardly discussed in the media. However, it seems that Qatar's similar stance will not be ignored. When asked whether gay couples can hold hands in public, Nasser Al-Khatib, who is the head of the Qatar World Cup project, said yes. In addition, Qatari officials stated that they will allow fans to drink alcohol. Hence, the Qatari government seems to have decided to lift some restrictions on fans during the tournament to avoid criticism. Despite changes in Qatar's posture, Western media has maintained its double standards against the hosting country. For instance, the BBC ignored the World Cup opening ceremony to criticize Qatar by not broadcasting it. However, it's the same BBC that televised the opening ceremonies for the Russian World Cup in 2018 and the Beijing Olympics in 2008, despite their appalling human rights records. Moreover, the British football team had protested Qatar for labor rights, but it has been revealed that the British Football Association's shirts, which cost about £115, or $139, and in rand terms translates to about 2,500 rand, right, were made by Thai workers working for sweatshops for £1 an hour. That's working for a paltry £1 an hour, that's 20 rand. Thus, while criticizing Qatar for conditions of workers, the British turned a blind eye to the conditions of workers manufacturing their T-shirts. So, based on this massive anti-Qatari coverage, the claim that Western media outlets have an Orientalist view against Qatar hosting the biggest football organization is not wrong. Of course, Qatar is both a Muslim and an Arab country, not to mention that it is in the south or countries of the south. The opposition to Qatar is not criticism for the sake of human rights, but seems to be an opportunity to insult Arab and Muslim cultures. Alcohol, LGBT activities, of course, are indeed forbidden in Qatar and many other Muslim countries because Islam and other religions forbid it. LGBT is not only forbidden in Islam, it's also forbidden in Christianity, in Judaism as well, and Hinduism in all other religions, or most other major religions. So Qatar partly allowed alcoholic drinks and promised not to intervene in the privacy of gay couples. But media and rights groups still continue to strike out at the Qatari government. While Qatar took one step back, the other side, which is the West and whoever supports them, including India, wants more and ignores Qatar's religious and cultural values. Right? Now, similar restrictions were applied by France, Russia and China, none of which are Muslim or Arab, but there was no media reaction at the time. Yet when the Qatari government exerted the same rules, it's faced with harsh criticism. Right? For example, in the 2016 UEFA Cup, France banned alcohol sales at stadiums. In the 2011 ICC Cricket World Cup in India, there were no alcohol sales at stadiums. It was banned. However, Qatar decides to ban alcohol sales at the stadiums, it becomes a problem. And you must know, it is not that there was no alcohol being consumed at the stadiums. In the corporate suites or the boxes, they were allowed, but that was controlled, it was measured. And of course, in the fan parks and outside in the public arena, it's been allowed. So why the big hua? And Qatar made it very clear that the reason why they're banning these the sale of alcohol at the stadiums is to prevent people from getting drunk, which leads to hooliganism. And that's a big problem, especially with the Europeans, the same fair-skinned white man who's making all these complaints. When they get drunk, they don't know how to behave. They become devils instantly. So some groups have a different agenda than enjoying the month-long football tournament. Besides peacefully finishing the tournament, Qatar will have to handle demonizing campaigns. And let's see what this small country can raise, you know, for all this anti-Qatari attacks that we are seeing right now. And that brings us to the opening ceremony, which took place this past Sunday. And it was something that caught the whole world by surprise. Of course, the actual show or the party of the opening ceremony was not that much appealing. There were better opening ceremonies in the past. However, the appearance of Ghanim Al-Mufta alongside with celebrity Morgan Freeman, and whereby Ghanim Al-Mufta, who is the disabled brother who suffers with the rare condition of caudal regression syndrome, meaning that the lower half of his body does not grow. In other words, he walks on his hands, right? He does not have a lower, it's a restrictive development to the lower half of his body. The two of them stole the show by reciting the verses of Surah Al-Hujjah, right? Mentioning how God has created male and female into different races and tribes so that you may live around the world but may recognize each other to that effect, right? And just this alone was enough to basically tell the whole world that we are part of this whole world village, that the world is not unique only to the West, to the white man's skin. And hats out to them. They did a good job and much respect. Okay, I have my reservations about Qatar being a monarchy, being a dictatorial like Saudi Arabia, like UAE, Kuwait, Bahrain, etc., Oman, most other countries in the Middle East, and that we like to see freedom where people can choose their leaders, right? However, as a country that is reforming, a country that is making these strides to uplifting not only its Qatari citizens, but even if you speak to the expats, a lot of South Africans that are living in Qatar compared to those living in the UAE, they are very happy. In fact, they don't want to come back. Right? Yes, there is restrictions. You don't get citizenship, etc. They'll give you long-term permits. Now, that's another issue. But the fact remains is that why this hypocrisy? Why this double standards? And when is it going to stop? I mean, take, for example, the opening ceremony was snubbed by the BBC because they want to feel that they are showing a principled stance. What? Because of the LGBT lobby? Because of alcohol sales? Right? Or, of course, not to forget, they are very principled at BBC. They worried about the migrant labors, right? Yet, the BBC has got no problem about how Arab money owns many of those stadiums in the UK, many of those soccer teams, Arsenal, Manchester City, etc., Newcastle United. They got no issues about that. They're very happy for their players to be for British white men playing for these soccer teams to earn these top salaries from these foreign owners. And then, of course, let's take the British expatriates, the British white men expatriates that are living in the Gulf, whether they're in the UAE, Kuwait, Qatar, etc., earning top dollar or top pounds, right? If you feel so strongly about it, then leave. Go back to Britain, right? Let other people fill in those opportunities and uplift themselves. There's no other word for it. Anyway, we can talk about that till the cows come home. But nevertheless, there's just a few other pressing issues. You know, there's the ICC, which is the International Criminal Court. And you've got the one under the United Nations General Assembly, which is known as the ICJ, which is the International Court of Justice. They've been criticized for only going after leaders of the third world, or leaders of that are not the white skin. However, let's not forget that Slobodan Milosevic, the butcher of Bosnia, the former president of Serbia, was also one of those that were hauled through the coals of the ICC and was found guilty for war crimes, along with his other subordinates like Mladic and Karadzic. These were the butchers of Bosnia. Right now, the thing is, why the criticism? Because you find that a lot of times they say they're only going after leaders of the third world that are not white, maybe Muslim, or whatever the story is, and they're not going after the Western leaders, which is true. But at the end of the day, how do you, as a person who criticizes the very existence of these courts, would react to something like this? And these are the sort of things that don't make the mainstream media, and you have to find it through other alternative media sites and through social media, that just on the 11th of November this year, that was a few weeks ago, the United Nations General Assembly's FOT Committee approved a resolution requesting the ICJ, which is the International Court of Justice, to urgently weigh in on Israel's prolonged occupation, settlement, and annexation of Palestinian territory. Yes, the motion would ask the International Court of Justice to analyze how Israeli policies and practices affect the legal status of the occupation and the legal consequences arising from this status and from Israel's denial of the right of to self-determination for the Palestinians. The draft resolution, which passed with, by 98-17 with 52 abstentions, focused on Palestinian territory occupied by Israel since 1967 war, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. It will then go to the United Nations General Assembly for a final vote before the end of the year. Now, something important like this, right, will raise the question, can the International Court of Justice help end Israel's occupation of Palestine? The very fact that it's out there is enough to upset, antagonize, and irritate Israel and give them sleepless nights, that they will put the Hasbara in full swing, in full force, to try and, you know, to show the positive image, their positive image based on what is happening here. So these courts have their place. We've seen it with the Rohingya not so long ago when that matter was brought in and what decisions were made out of that Court of Justice. So although these rulings are symbolic and non-binding, the very fact that they're taking place, it means a lot. It means a lot to the people that have been affected. Therefore, let's work with the baby steps for now and take the major steps at a later time. That's all we have for dear listeners. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.